Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. A big new exhibit on Adolf Hitler has opened in the heart of Berlin at the German Historical Museum, across the street from where Hitler's Nazis famously burned books in a huge bonfire. It's billed as the first major Hitler exhibit in Germany since World War II. It's called Hitler and the Germans, Nation and Crime, and it's got the world's attention. The objects on display are low-key, not grand. Nazi piggy banks, lamps, playing cards, toy figurines. The theme is how average Germans came to embrace the Führer. This hour on Point, Hitler and his Germany on display. You can join the conversation. What's your reaction to news of this exhibit? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Berlin is Dr. Simone Erpel, curator at the German Historical Museum. She's a co-curator of the new exhibit, Hitler and the Germans, Nation and Crime. Dr. Erpel, Simone, thank you very much for joining us today.
Okay, thank you. Hello, Tom, hello. Constanze, and Jonathan.
Yes, you know my guest as well as I do here. with me in the studio in Boston, Constanze Stelzenmüller, senior transatlantic scholar at the German Marshall Fund, a former defense and international security editor at the German weekly Die Zeit. Constanze Stelzenmüller, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you.
And I should introduce as well American historian Jonathan Zatlin, professor of German and European history at Boston University. He's working on a new book about Jews, money, and the German state. Jonathan Zatlin, thank you very much for being here.
Great to be here, Tom.
Dr. Erpel, Simone Erpel, first to you. Why a Hitler exhibit now in the heart of Berlin?
First of all, it's exhibition about Hitler and the connection with the German society. It's not only a Hitler exhibit. And I guess after 65 years after the Second World War, it was time for this exhibition.
We'll talk about the and society part, but give us just a visual sense of what is in this exhibit. Where is it? Where is your museum in Berlin? And what's inside its walls? What's in the exhibit right now?
The historical German museum is in the center of Berlin. It's in the former Zeughaus. And near the Brandenburger Tor.
Mm-hmm.
And the other question was?
Well, just if we were to visit your exhibit today, share with us what kind of things we would see.
You see pictures, of course, from Hitler, but also from the German society from the 1990s until today. But you see also Alltagskultur.
That's daily culture, daily objects used by normal
Germans.
Yes,
daily objects and some teppich, wandteppich, who were some objects.
Typical
wall carpets.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm,
who were made from the German society, for example.
Yeah, mm-hmm. There's a Gobelin, I think.
Yes,
a Gobelin with Nazi motifs that a wealthy family would have hung up. I know, I saw the picture.
This is art from that time.
Mm-hmm. Art with...
It's another one. It's from... It was in... in the church, this carpet was hanging in the.
Oh, this is a tapestry.
This tapestry was made from a woman from a little town in Hessen, in Rothenburg, in the 30s.
Wow.
And you see a cross and also the swastika, and the motif is we bring the swastika into the church.
Lots of daily objects to try and convey, as you say, Dr. Erpel, how Germans related to the rise of this of Hitler and the Nazi Party, all kinds of response there in Germany. Here's one response. This is from outside the new exhibit there. German Hans Koppe spoke with the BBC in the last couple of days about his reactions as a German to the museum's display.
This man who is responsible for the deaths of my parents and million other people, it is a not good feeling for me.
Constanze Stelzenmüller, what about Germans looking at this figure and German society at the time of Hitler's rise? Do you agree with Dr. Erpel? Is it time? Is it past time for Germans to sort of have it all there in the exhibit, complete with, you know, it's low-key. It's not the big, grandiose Nazi symbols, but you've got your swastikas and your busts of Hitler and all the rest. Is it time, Constanze?
Well, I think this exhibition really comes on the tail end of what has become a mainstream recognition that a great number of Germans colluded, co-conspired, and, you know, became co-criminals in the Holocaust and in World War II by making themselves part of the system. And what you see here really, if you will, are the very mundane day-to-day objects that symbolize this. It's, I mean, most of us have the larger images, the photographs from the concentration camps, the Nazi propaganda movies burnt in our mental retinas. And to some degree, these objects are, you know, only the mundane reminders of something that was much more awful.
Though they're still quite potent in their way. I mean, just a paper lamp with a swastika on it, a cigar box, a set of playing cards with the with the faces, including Adolf Hitler, of the Nazi leadership. I mean, at this point, Constanze, what's your sense of how this resonates with Germans? Is this all well known behind them? Is it still relevant? Are they still taking lessons? Or
I think most of us have accepted fully, except some very elderly and deluded people, or the, you know, the right wing fringe, which is mercifully small. Most of us have accepted that many Germans were a part of this dreadful machinery of killing, and these objects, I think, to us are in some ways mundane, but also very creepy. I think to all of us, you know, there is a sense of the hair standing back on the back of your neck, standing up on the back of your neck when you see these things, because they are so mundane and represent something that was so horrible.
Dr. Erpel, I wonder about the reaction. I know when a wax figure of Adolf Hitler came into your wax museum there in Berlin, I think it was standing next to Heidi Klum or someone, somebody came in and knocked the head off of that wax figure. What kind of turnout? What kind of audience are you having? Big numbers? And how are people responding to what they see there in Berlin?
There's another figure of Adolf Hitler. It's in a little
wax
Panopticum.
Museum.
Panopticum. Yeah. It stands there since the 50s. And no one removed this figure. It's a scene in the bunker together with Göring and Mussolini and Eva Braun, but nobody touched it. I think it's überbewertet.
That was an exaggerated reaction. The thing was, I think this happened in a subsidiary.
It was only a joke to kill Hitler at Madame Tussauds.
Symbolically. And what about the turnout for your new exhibit? Have you had large crowds since you opened last Friday?
Haben Sie viele Besucher gehabt?
We have until today about 20,000 visitors.
Wow.
From last Friday. There you have to wait 1 hour to visit the special exhibition. And I go downstairs. It's in the underground etage. Basement. It's in the basement, and it's very concentrate atmosphere. It's very silent, and you see young German people, but also tourists from abroad. They are reading all this information and looking at the pictures and the objects and the films. And it is very touching, this atmosphere. It's very serious.
Jonathan Zetlin.
No one who want to see, oh, where is my my very special Hitler portrait, or I want to see the swastika or something like that.
A kind of serious, even somber response. Jonathan Zetlin, how are you looking on? We just got a minute before the break, but looking on from across the sea at this in Berlin now, 2010, 65 years after the end of World War II, what's your first reaction to this exhibit been?
Well, I guess at one level I'm really surprised that at this point, one would want to put on an exhibition like this, partly because the fascination that Germans have had, demonization of Hitler, but also the fascination with him, is such a constant part since 1945, since 1933, really since the mid-20s of German society. So the idea that there's some kind of taboo here is rather odd. But at the same time, obviously, the forces that bring Hitler to power continue to be so difficult to explain, in particular to the people who are the descendants of those who either suffered from or were involved in this machinery of destruction. And I think that's what we're really dealing with. That's the 20,000.
Is there still something for the world to learn here in this exhibit about Hitler, or is there a risk of learning the wrong thing?
There's always a risk of learning the wrong thing, and I certainly don't think that this sort of notion that if we use history as a kind of arsenal to protect ourselves from repeating it, I mean, I think that that's, from a historian's perspective, a somewhat dubious idea. But all of this history is always used in a political sense, especially in democracies, to warn about the dangers of demagoguery and anti-democratic thought.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the big new Hitler exhibit in Berlin, Hitler and German Society, as my guest today points out. Germany's first focused exclusively on the Führer and his rise to power since World War II. Dr. Simone Erpel is with us, a curator at the German Historical Museum in Berlin, where the exhibit is now underway. 20,000 have already visited just since last Friday, she tells us. Constanze Stelzenmüller is with me in the studio here, senior transatlantic fellow at the German Marshall Fund of the United States, former defense and international security editor at the German weekly paper Die Zeit. And Jonathan Zetlin is here, professor of German and European history at Boston University. 65 years after the end of World War II, can we talk about everything, put it all, Hitler included, on the table? Can we look at Hitler without fear of reviving his demons? And here's just a reminder of those demons. This is a bit from the closing speech featured in the 1934 propaganda film Triumph of the Will. Hitler encouraging his audience of more than 30,000 Germans to take up arms to defend their beliefs. The speech took place at a huge rally in Nuremberg.
Es wird stets nur ein Teil eines Volkes aus wirklich aktiven Kämpfern bestehen.
And let's remember what was being said there. He's saying here, there's always a part of the people who stand out as really active fighters. More is expected from them than from the millions of national comrades in the general population. For them, Hitler's saying here, it's not simply enough to make the pledge, I believe, rather the affirmation, I fight. And that, a propaganda film, 1934. Now we've got this exhibit. Simone, what is it? What is the theme that you're conveying about German society and Adolf Hitler, the relationship or the public support that he found? What will we learn from your exhibit about the character of that relationship?
Very important at that point, that the German society was not the victims of perfect propaganda machine of Hitler. The message of our exhibition is that the society have their own hopes, and they gave Hitler his charismatic power. That is one main message of the exhibition. And I think that that is a part we can learn from this exhibition. Not to see, oh, it's a charismatic person, but to see that also the society is responsibility for the conditions and made a great leader like Adolf Hitler.
Great in the sense of certainly powerful, not great in the sense of outcomes or path. I guess we understand that. Jonathan Zatlin, when you look at this, I think a lot of Americans, a lot of people around the world still wonder, as you say, how did this happen? And the exhibit is quite determinedly looking at the society around the man, calls him unprepossessing, you know, just not that impressive, not, as Simone Erpel says from Berlin, a leadership built on charisma here. On the other hand, in that Nuremberg speech, there's a kind of wild charisma there, and you hear the crowd's response. Take us back. You're the historian at the dance between German society and this one man and how it grew into what it became.
Well, I think the first thing we should say is something about Hitler's person himself and the way in which Germans have seen him really, like I said, since the 20s, as either an uncanny figure. I think Constanze mentioned the creepiness, that there was an interpretation of Hitler as a highly charismatic individual, obviously propelled by fanatical supporters, fanaticism, propaganda. These were all positive ideas. They weren't seen as bad at the time. They were seen as linked to youth, or as
someone who's in the 20s,
in the 30s. Right. So, you know, sort of a youthful, forceful character, willing and able to solve all sorts of problems. And German society at the time was beset by all sorts of problems. Mm-hmm. Or a lot of people saw him as unlikely, unprepossessing, incompetent, not very bright, self-educated, et cetera, and so forth. And I think the truth obviously lies somewhere in the middle. There's a tendency on the left in Germany in particular to view this man as inept politically. In fact, he's quite talented. It's true that the incompetence of his adversaries contributed to his victories. It's also true that despite the incredible obstacles to German democracy, all the sorts of problems that beset it, from economic crises to the defeat in World War I, what have you, it did last for quite some time. Hitler had several chances, wasn't able to take power as quickly as Mussolini did in Italy.
The democracy lasted before
the democracy was much more durable than I think we would want to think in some ways. But at the same time, you know, he was very smart when it came to new forms of mass media. He was extremely gifted. Didn't have the most wonderful voice, as you heard from the clip. That's not what he was able to do. He was not given in terms of phrase the way Mussolini was. He wasn't a brilliant public speaker in that sense, but he was brilliant in a totally different sense. He knew how to stack an audience. He knew how to come on late, get people all excited about him, and then speak to their emotions. In that sense, it was the politics of resentment, and he was very good at that. But the point is that I think he spoke to all sorts of cleavages in German society of the time, and spoke in a way that was much more coherent, understandable, accessible, but also I think became a kind of repository for a lot of people's hopes and desires. It's not just that this wasn't the politics of negation only. The Nazis and the people who supported them, and I would say most Germans by the 30s had come to support various portions of the National Socialist society, that these goals were clearly articulated. They knew what they wanted to do, and they knew what they needed to do in order to get there.
Through all of this, Constanze, and it's very clear in this exhibit from what I'm seeing online here, and I should say we've got quite a gallery of photos from the exhibit at our website, onpointradio.org, but this idea of Volksgemeinschaft, can you explain that for us? What was that, and what was the power of it?
Yes. Oddly, it's been translated with the word nation, which doesn't begin to describe this. The Volksgemeinschaft is better translated with the word community, and what it meant that in National Socialist ideology,
or almost transliterally, folks,
the people, the Vox community, exactly, and meaning that the unity of an ethnically pure, that of course was a total illusion. Germany being in the middle of Europe, was never ethnically pure in any way, shape, or form. But the idea that the community of ethnically pure Germans, meaning everybody who was not Jewish or a gypsy or Polish or any other kind of what the Nazis considered undesirable aliens.
Or gay as it rolled out.
Or gay, of course, or obviously politically opposed to the system, that this community of ethnically pure Germans would think and act as one, and create a political movement in which the rights and the thinking and the feelings and the needs of the individual would be completely irrelevant. I mean, that's the definition of fascism.
And it wouldn't matter because they're all the folk in the movement, exactly. Jonathan.
Yeah, actually, come back to this idea of Volksgemeinschaft, which we translate, most historians, as the racial community. Mm-hmm. It's speaking, I mean, racial is also not quite getting at this idea of the folk, the people. And there are two things that this phrase or this word is speaking to. Mm-hmm. One is Gemeinschaft, the community versus society. Mm-hmm. A society is a place in which people agree to disagree.
Exactly.
We have political parties, mm-hmm. we have democracy, we have parliamentary mm-hmm. indirect
sure. representation. All kinds of elements and segments.
This is something that for fascists isn't just absolutely unsupportable. You have to be on one page. You must be unified. Mm-hmm. The will of the Führer is
more tightly bound. That's more unified.
Absolutely. And there's something awful about the kind of corrosive influence of people who disagree, mm-hmm. because they're just naysayers. They're people who stand out in the various ethnic, sexual, whatever the mm-hmm. problem is. These are the people you want to really get rid of, the internal enemies. The first part of the word, folk here, as mm-hmm. Constanze was saying,
yes.
some of it really does have to do with ethnicity and religion and things like this, but some of it has to do with this notion of the nation versus the state. And the problem after the German defeat...
And this is hard for Americans because nation here, we use it interchangeably with country, but in Europe it
I'm
often means
so sure
a racial...
True.
Or well, there may be a version of it here.
Think about the Tea Party and the way in which there are certain kind of assaults on government and the notion of the state.
There's a community that's deeper than the state.
That's right.
Exactly.
Or
more
that's exactly
original.
Older than the
right.
state and mm-hmm. more important than the state.
More
exactly.
important than
so,
the state.
So mm-hmm. democracy is an illegitimate form of the state when it comes to the German people.
Yep.
And that's a powerful argument that I think pulled in lots of people who otherwise might not have liked various aspects of fascism.
The argument had its own power. That is made clear in Simone Erpel's exhibit in Berlin. But Jonathan, it was always laced around with violence if you didn't agree.
Absolutely. There's no question that there was intimidation. Some people thought the intimidation was fantastic. That was the whole cleaning up Germany, getting rid of, I mean, the amount of anti-communism. I remember years ago now talking to...
But if you weren't a Nazi, you were a socialist? I mean, but it was called National Socialism.
Right. Well, that's the wonderful thing about the Nazis, right? It was a National Socialist German Workers' Party,
which
makes no
Nazi.
Sense. So many contradictions.
Explain that. Explain
well,
that.
First of all, how can you be a national and socialist at the same time? The whole point of socialism was international, the working class that has bonds with itself all across the world.
Okay.
So how can you be national mm-hmm. socialist, but also German workers? If you're a worker, then you should, I don't know, feel much more solidarity with people in Russia or in France than you should with your employer who's German.
Well, so you say, but then you hear a lot of Americans who aren't exactly feeling solidarity with, Chinese factory workers.
Absolutely. No, I'm not. That's mm-hmm. the whole point about the Nazis. I think uh-huh. they understood that there were these utopian ideas, these notions of solidarity mm-hmm. across class throughout the world that actually people didn't necessarily believe in.
Simone Erpel in Berlin, do you represent the violence that surrounded Adolf Hitler well before the war began, the political violence in Germany in this exhibit?
Yes, of course. It's one essential of the concept of our exhibition. We show how the political opponents were perpetrated and were
persecuted,
sent in concentration camps. And we have also... for example, we show in one kind of showcase the modernity of the 30s with telephone and the so-called Volksempfänger, special radio for the population, for the population. But we also show the plan of the concentration camp Sachsenhausen, which was built in the in 1936.
Mm.
Also, it's a dark side of the modernity. It's had a form as a triangle. That is the way we represent the violence in our exhibition.
Mm-hmm. I want to bring in our callers, and our very first one is from Germany. Preston joins us from the Ronstein Air Force Base, U.S. Air Force Base in south of Frankfurt in Germany. Preston, thank you very much for calling. What are you thinking?
Thank you, Tom, for having me. I'm actually quite surprised at the controversy surrounding this exhibit. I've been in Germany for 3 years now.
Mm-hmm.
And many of the museums around here, like the Technik Museum in Speyer, has many Nazi memorabilia throughout the museum. And when I saw this on the national media, it kind of caught me off guard. The Germans are very open about their history with the Nazis, and to see all this controversy surrounding it is not the feeling you get over here at all.
Well, let me ask you, I mean, when you say controversy, I think a lot of people are interested. Do you see controversy in Germany at all about it, Preston? Are you plugged in?
Not at all, not at all. We live on the community here in Germany. There's no outrage or anything about it. But when you read the national papers, and I get all my news back in the States from the Internet, all the websites and news sources seem to be pointing that this is causing quite a stir back in the States, that this is the kind of stuff that should be avoided.
It's very interesting. Preston, I appreciate your call there from Ramstein Air Force Base. Thank you very much. Constanze, you're just here from Germany, just over. I mean, what about the reception to the notion? Many people, only 20,000 out of the whole world have seen it so far, but, you know, many people are paying attention. Is it, what about the response to this in Germany, its ordinariness or its unusualness? What about the response you're seeing from Americans scratching their heads about it, Constanze?
Well, I think if you look at the reporting, even outside of Germany, the serious reporting acknowledges that German society has by now done a fairly complete and thorough and sincere accounting of what happened. My point would be that it took us a long time. And that's, I said earlier that this exhibition comes on the tail end, but it comes on the tail end of a development that took us about 40 to 50 years. The thing for, that maybe non-Germans don't quite realize is that right after 1945, for about 20 years, the theory that many Germans subscribed to and that was taught in schools was that Hitler was part of a very small band of charismatic criminals. He was a Svengali who had seduced the German
which
people.
Which kind of exonerated the German people.
And which exonerated the German people. Mm-hmm. And it took us... it took the Nuremberg trials of 1946, then our own trials against the Nazis, which came 20 years later, the Auschwitz trials in 1964, and then the Holocaust series produced, the TV series produced in America in 1979, which was shown to enormous public response and concern in Germany. Mm-hmm. Then the Wehrmacht exhibition, which proved that the Wehrmacht had in fact collaborated very actively in the crimes.
That is, it wasn't just the SS doing the atrocities, it was
the
regular army.
It was the regular army and committing atrocities all across Central and Eastern Europe, and the Balkans and Greece. And then finally, I think the last piece in the puzzle, or in the last link in the chain, was a book that was published a couple of years ago by the German historian Götz Ali, that demonstrated in great detail how ordinary Germans had profited from the disappearance of their Jewish friends and neighbors by doing things like picking up their property and appropriating it after
the
they'd
house,
been
the
deported.
Shop, the
precisely, the furniture, the mattresses, ordinary things. And this by now, I think, it is only fair to say, has become common consciousness in Germany. We know this. We know that many Germans colluded, collaborated. There, as I, a minority still denies this, but they are a small minority.
Jonathan, is Germany ahead of the world, the U.S., in understanding the dynamics
that.
Around? I'm just asking. in understanding the dynamics around Hitler and the Nazi Party.
If I may, just before I answer that question, I agree with Constanze on largely what she's saying, but I don't think this is ever done. I mean, one purpose of the exhibition seems to be to speak to people who have no memory of fascism, even through the 1960s, certainly 1979, the Holocaust series. I mean, we think also of East Germans having a very different way of understanding, at least, and also a different kind of dictatorship. Right, and I think we should be very careful about including East Germans in this. So I would say that first, and I would also say that, you know, yes, Hitler is the uncanny or unlikely figure. This is all about the culpability of ordinary people at the time.
Exactly.
And it has taken quite some time for Germans not to describe themselves as victims, although that, I think, is much more a part of German culture than you're willing to allow, I'd argue. And one aspect of that that we see constantly repeated is the problem dealing with Germany as a multicultural society. Either it's described as a society that's not about immigration, it doesn't have any minorities, or that it does very well by its minorities who are simply obstreperous. I mean, I think this is something that is a really big problem in Germany.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Big New Hitler exhibit in Berlin, Germany's first focused exclusively on the Führer since World War II. Dr. Simone Erpel, one of the curators of the German Historical Exhibit, where this a museum where this exhibit opened last Friday, is very graciously with us from Berlin. With me in the studio, Constanze Stelzenmüller, Senior Transatlantic Fellow at the German Marshall Fund of the U.S., and Professor of German and European History at Boston University, Jonathan Zatlin. You can see a gallery of images from the exhibit at our website, onpointradio.org. We'll get to your calls. Constanze, I wonder if you could just describe a few more of the things we're seeing here. I mean, I've seen this kind of paper lamp. I've seen an exhibit of busts of Hitler. They were made in the millions in those years. Simone Erpel and the curators have said they very deliberately did not bring in the kind of huge, grandiose, you know, items of the Nazi time. They're not looking here to excite that feeling. They're looking to make it plain, in a way. Mm-hmm.
Well, clearly what the curators of this exhibition, which I myself, because I'm currently in America, have only been able to see on the internet myself, but I do encourage listeners to go see it there, because you can see a series of very interesting images, and the New York Times and others have also posted slideshows on the web.
There's little toy soldiers, a little toy figurine of Hitler at a podium with his Heil Hitler salute going on.
There's propaganda pictures, there's playing cards, there's even a box of cigars, which the brand is called the People's Cigar, but the model is called the Chancellor.
And images in all of this are from the very entrance of the exhibit of the German people behind this man, not the man alone, but the crowds.
What this is supposed to illustrate is how the National Socialists, who were very, very clever propagandists indeed, try to insinuate their way into ordinary life by branding every mundane object with the insignia, with the ideas, with the images of National Socialist thinking, with the swastika, obviously. I mean, that's the most well-known symbol, but with pictures of Adolf Hitler, and with representations of the key ideas of the ideology. And clearly, they were very successful in this.
We've got questions for Dr. Erpel. Mark in New Britain, Connecticut. Mark, you're on the air.
Yes, Tom, thanks for taking my call. Dr. Zatlin, your last comments just before each break really hit home for me. I'm seeing across Europe the rise of a somewhat more civilized right wing, from the French outlawing of the burqa to the rise of Geert Wilders to, I beg your pardon, but Germany's discomfort with the Turks. And I wonder, looking at this, whether all these, you know, mostly banal objects as an illustration of this is how evil creeps over the windowsill into our lives. And I wonder, Dr. Erkel, whether that thought was present in your mind as a warning to the present day when you put this exhibit together.
We'll ask both, Mark, and I thank you for your call. Simone Erpel in Berlin, are you trying with this exhibit to raise a kind of warning to societies in Europe or beyond?
Sorry, the line was bad. I can't understand your question, please.
Frau Erpel, ich sag's mal auf Deutsch. Er fragt, ob Sie versucht haben, eine Lehre für heute zu illustrieren mit diesen Objekten für diejenigen, die heutzutage von sozusagen rechten Gedanken versucht sind.
Is there a warning?
Yes, it's a warning, but in a positive way, to think about the value of democracy, and it's ein Aufruf.
It's a call
for more civil courage. Mm-hmm. For example,
civil courage,
because you see the main society during the Nazi period, they followed Hitler and they
profited from him
and that's the lesson from the exhibition.
Jonathan Zatlin, do you see a warning in here for Germans or for Americans today? We have angry politics, we have economic turmoil and stress. Is there always a warning, or is it a cliche to think, oh gosh, you know, we've got upheaval and anger and stress, so we need to worry about Nazi style rising?
Well, I think on the heels of any kind of economic crisis, we should always be very concerned about how those resentments that I think are natural and part of living in a modern society can get used for political ends. Having said that, the problem with nation states, whether it's America, whether it's Germany, is that it always produces this moment where you're supposed to be American, and being not American is a problem. So xenophobia, all sorts of racialized resentments, this is kind of common fare that you see whenever there's an economic downturn. It gets a lot worse. It's part of being in a nation state. And the problem I see with the exhibition from this, across the Atlantic, not having been there, the very little that I can see online, my question, and this is also based on what Dr. Apa was saying, mm-hmm. is, being in a democracy isn't just about tyranny versus, or despotism of some kind, versus the ability to choose what you want and not have somebody tell you to do what you don't want to do. It's also about tolerating other people. It's about tolerating difference. And I think that these are always cultural problems. In other words, they're different in America than they are in Germany.
Why does that rise in the context of this exhibit?
Because part of the thing that I thought got lost in the very little that I've seen of the exhibit in terms of the objects and in terms of what the curators have said about the purpose of it is that Jews were very much a part of German society. And although there is this moment in the exhibition in which you can't think of the Volksgemeinschaft, that racial community, without thinking about minorities and Jews, it doesn't seem to be central. And in fact, it was central to the whole, not just the purpose of the Nazi leadership, but of the people who supported the Nazis. It was a big part of what mobilized support. And this is a problem in the United States, too. I think that when we think about what it means to be American at this point, mm-hmm. questions about immigrants, questions about tolerating other people and their ideas, whether you're on the right or on the left, about lifestyle, become a big part of what it means to live in a democratic society.
Americans may still debate it, though, but we've long since, in large portion, thrown our arms around this idea that America is a diverse country. We're a nation of immigrants.
Yes and no. Let me give a good example. This goes back to your mm-hmm. question beforehand about the exhibit. I mean, in a way, this is just absolutely amazing. Germany is really singular in the world, I think. If you think about the crimes that were committed by Germans in the name of Germans, it's really one of the few, if not the only country that has exhibitions, museums, monuments devoted to what they did and why it was wrong. Not only that, but as Constanze can say about the German Marshall Fund, German organizations, official state-run organizations, promote people like me, invite me, pay for me to come over to Germany, look at documents, and critique Germany.
If you are you complimenting?
I'm definitely complimenting. I think this is fantastic. That doesn't mean that it's a kind of mission that's ever over. It's something that I think in a nation state you always have to be involved in. Look at America for a second. When my wife and I came from California to Boston, mm-hmm. we went to Little Bighorn. And in that...
I mean, you stopped off driving across country
I-90,
to the famous...
I-90, you're driving across country. We saw all kinds of great
west.
Things.
Yeah.
And, I was appalled at the museum there, which does this very strange thing.
The way Native Americans are depicted.
Exactly. There's mm-hmm. the heroism of Custer, mm-hmm. Which this is not to say that the man himself was not mm-hmm. heroic. Mm-hmm. But, of course, the values that he stood for are not values, I think, that we want to promote.
So watch out wherever you stand in this world. We'll look at the contemporary scene in Germany in a minute. It's absolutely fascinating how everybody is thinking about this in lots of countries often these days. But I want to go to the history. Simone Erpel, what about this question of how people in the 1920s, let's say, in Germany, are depicted in your exhibit, people who were not part of the Volksgemeinschaft, not part of the notion of racially pure Germans? How do you represent them? Gypsies, Jews, outsiders,
communists,
gays, communists,
socialists.
Yes.
Do you mean after Hitler take over power, or before in the 20s?
Well, I mean during the time of the rise to power. What does the exhibit have to say about how these people were treated, about their path during that time?
I think there are a lot of different opinions. For example, as far as I know, there are also Jewish German part of the were also fans of Hitler, for example.
Wow.
It was not, and were also right. It's hard for me to.
Mm-hmm. But I think you've misunderstood the question, if I may.
My question's pretty vague here, and I apologize for that.
If I could quickly sort of do a bit of translation here.
Yeah.
The question is about what mention you make of the Holocaust and the exclusionary politics that led to the Holocaust.
Yeah, even before the Holocaust, during the rise.
Yes. Erwähnen Sie sozusagen die Verfolgung und Vernichtung von Andersdenkenden und von Juden, von Homosexuellen und so weiter?
Okay. Yeah. Yes, of course. It's part of our exhibition. For example, we show pictures who were made from the Gestapo of Würzburg and show the deportation of the Jews from Mainfranken. And also, for example, the Yellow Star as a, mm-hmm. Not a single, but a part of
The printed yellow stars on entire bales of cloth that were then cut out and distributed.
I see, ready to be distributed for everybody, for Jews in Germany.
Wear,
But this is a moment.
For me, it's one... picture or one painting is very
important,
moving, because on the one side you see a young woman with a cross on her neck, but this painting was made by a soldier, a German soldier, during the Second World War, and it was of one part of a Torah roll.
Torah.
It was painted on a Torah roll, you mean?
Yes, painted on the Torah roll. And as far as we know, it is a part from the first book of Moses. Mm-hmm. And you see the one side, the painting, and you see also the backside of the destroyed Torah roll.
Let's get a quick call. Edward in Nashville. Edward, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'd like to know what the thoughts are of Bolshevism, and, you know, communism was terrified a lot of the Germans in that area during that time, which brought Hitler to power. And the reason I ask that is because, one, my grandfather served in the Ukrainian division of the German army, and my grandmother loved Hitler because her parents and herself and her sister were able to go back to Germany after World War One when they were, you know, there was no work, that Hitler put them all back to work. So it wasn't until later in the war... Mm-hmm. When everything was falling apart and, you know, all the bombings and all that, and found out what his grand plan was, in the beginning they loved him because of those two points.
What about fear of communism as a driver of support?
Absolutely,
Jonathan?
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's worthwhile pointing out that the communists never pulled enough, never were truly a danger to German democracy. But at the same time, lots of people, middle-class people who had property, had savings, were really afraid, not just in Germany. I mean, you see this in the United States in the 1920s, the same sorts of anti-communist hysteria that is perhaps not based in any actual factual threat, but nevertheless, people are really worried about it. And it's not just the Nazis, but the Nazis are perhaps more deft than others, tapping into those middle-class fears of anti-communism. I should also point out, and I think the caller did a wonderful job of bringing in another, this odd paradox of fascism. German fascism, the Ukrainian SS, he's, I think, referring not to the Wehrmacht, but the SS units. You know, the SS was an incredibly racist organization, mm-hmm. all built on sorts of racial hierarchies, but they managed to pull in, it becomes actually an incredibly, it's an affirmative action plan, if you like. They pull in Ukrainians, they pull in all sorts of peoples who they don't like and think are racially inferior by appealing to their anti-communism. And certainly that was, I think, for a lot of Ukrainians, it wasn't just an imaginary threat. It was a real threat. Living under Stalin at that time and being Ukrainian was a very difficult thing.
Constanza, a lot of Americans will have heard on the news in the last couple of days the German Chancellor, Angela Merkel, saying that, you know, all the immigration that Germany has had has been a failure. She said the multicultural approach has failed. And they're going to wonder if this is an echo of what we saw then.
No, it's not. I think it's very important to understand that in context. What she was saying was that in earlier politics, of integration, which was a non-policy of integration, had failed completely.
A non-policy of integration?
Which was simply to let people be, to not ask them to learn German, to not ask them to let their daughters and wives learn German, to not ask them to learn about German democracy and the German system, and to make it very difficult for people who wanted to become citizens and get passports to do so. What this government is now doing is saying, we will make it easier for you to get passports, but you do have to learn German. You do have to become, you know, participant members of society.
Our time is short, but Jonathan, is this an echo of the past? Is this a current?
I would always hesitate to say to point out any aspect of German society and say, okay, well, there's the Nazi part right there. I mean, I don't think that's what we're seeing, but we are seeing unresolved issues in German society when it comes to immigrants or people who are not perceived to be German. And there's always a demand. And I think here I would disagree with Constanze. I certainly disagree with Merkel and other voices on the left as well as on the right. I think there's a confusion between assimilation and integration. There's always this tendency, it seems, for people to demand that Turks, for example, become German in certain kinds of ways.
No, but that's not what's happening. I'm sorry. They're not being asked to assimilate. They're being asked to integrate. And what an earlier policy, and it was condoned by both the right and the left of center in Germany was doing, was allowing people to simply self-ghettoize.
Yeah. We won't solve this one today. The history looms over us even now. Dr. Erpel, how long will your exhibit be up there in Berlin at the museum? Until when?
Until the February next year.
Next February at the German Historical Museum in Berlin. Dr. Simone Erpel, staff curator there, we're very grateful to you for your time and your insights today. Thank you for joining us.
Yes, thank you too.
Jonathan Zatlin? Brave to put this on? Enlightening?
I don't think it was brave, but certainly very important. An attempt to really reflect back at Germans the extent to which there was a lot of popular support for this regime.
Jonathan Zatlin at Boston University, thank you so much for joining
us
today.
Thank you very much.
And Constanze Seltzenmüller, with the Transatlantic Fellow with the German Marshall Fund, thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me here. It's
listeners,
a pleasure.
Thank you for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook.